Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149, and then you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you'll be placed in the queue to be on air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. In 1954, the Supreme Court stated it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he's denied the opportunity of an education. Yet providing for and financing secondary education is an issue currently facing our nation at every level. Debates ensue about the value and right to education, and as a country, whose education we're prioritizing. This debate is nothing new for those working on educational issues for youth who are involved in the juvenile justice system. These youth are most at risk and have high rates of behavioral and developmental disabilities. Equity and quality in education for youth who have been removed from their homes and placed in correctional detention settings remains a problem for a variety of reasons. Today we have Peter Leone and David Domenici to discuss the current issues related to educating youth in institutional settings and share ideas on how to develop educational programming that meets individual youth needs and supports their reintegration back into the community and local school systems. Dr. Peter Leone is a professor of special education at the University of Maryland, where he focuses on behavior disorders. His experience includes direct service to troubled youth, as well as field-based research which examines the multidimensional problems associated with behavioral disorders. Peter points to the role of environmental and cultural factors in the inception of behavior disorders and believes educators need to take a multidisciplinary approach when implementing programs for troubled or troubling youth. His research interests focus on program environments, educational entitlements of incarcerated youth, and policy studies. From 1999 to 2006, he directed the National Center on Education, Disability, and Juvenile Justice, a research training and technical assistance project. Dr. Leone has had numerous articles published in professional journals, is a frequent speaker on topics related to the effective treatment and instruction of behaviorally disordered youth, and has served on many boards, including the Justice Policy Institute and the See Forever Foundation. David Domenici is a former corporate attorney who quit his job in 1997 and with a colleague started the Maya Angelou Public Charter School, designed for court-involved teens. For 10 years, he served as the organization's executive director and principal of its initial campus. Under his leadership, the school grew from a row house serving 20 young men to a multi-campus organization educating more than 700 at-risk students. In 2007, the charter school was asked to take over the school at Oak Hill, Washington, D.C.'s long-term juvenile correctional facility, long considered one of the worst juvenile prisons in the nation. David designed the school's program, hired all the staff, and became the founding principal of the school called the Maya Angelou Academy, which has since won national recognitions for its accomplishments in working with incarcerated young men. Recently, David left the academy and is researching the viability of starting a center to advance the educational programming in a number of state juvenile and adult facilities. He has been an Echoing Green and Ashoka Fellow and was a member of the Washington Post Principals Leadership Institute. Welcome, gentlemen, to Spotlight on Youth.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us, Lauren.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We have so much to talk about today, and I really want listeners to hear from both of you about promising practices and philosophical approaches to educational programming that fosters not only learning, but pride, hope, and success from both the youth perspective and those working in educational settings. So perhaps we can start, why don't you share why education is such a critical component and important to rehabilitation?
Sure. Let me take that one and start off here, Lauren. I think many of us who are educated or well educated, perhaps take education and some of the benefits that are associated with it for granted. But if you look at the differences between kind of adult outcomes for those with a good education and those without it, the differences are pretty astounding. If you look at employment, if you look at housing, the quality of housing, if you look at health, and if you look at poverty, just four indicators, the differences between those who are well-educated, those who have things like high school diplomas and certificates in vocational or technical areas, those who have college degrees, the differences between those that have those and those that don't are just striking. The biggest one, and one that's most pressing, of course, is employment opportunities. But if you look at kids who are incarcerated, leaving facilities no better educated and no more skilled than when they entered, they're at great risk for rearrest and reincarceration. And so strictly from a kind of a public policy perspective, it doesn't make sense to incarcerate kids for a period of time with the idea that you're going to habilitate them and not provide quality services to them, quality educational services.
Right, and to add to that, particularly for young men who are locked up on the younger end of the spectrum who are really far behind, like reading at the first, second, third grade level, to follow up what Peter said, if they're sort of housed for 9 months or 18 months, and even if they get their mental health needs met and develop a better sense of who they are, they have to go back to their community and most likely have to go back to a public high school. And ironically, in a secure correctional setting, you have a really great chance to educate them, and you really need to be obligated to do that. This is your chance to take someone who reads at the fourth grade level and work incredibly hard with him so that by the time he leaves at the sixth or seventh grade level. And if you're reading at the sixth or seventh grade level and you're with a bunch of other kids in the ninth or tenth grade class, you actually can compete and can feel normal and feel good about yourself and can potentially be successful. But if you go right back out there and you're reading at the third or fourth grade level, again, candidly, even if your self-esteem is better and you have some better strategies to cope with difficult situations, you're back in high school and you're reading like a third grader and you're in a big classroom, you're just pretty doomed once again. So the real key here is arming the young men with the skills they need so they can be successful and have a good chance of being successful when they get reintegrated in schools.
Great. And before we get into sort of some of the challenges and opportunities, what we're talking about both detention and correctional facilities. What are sort of the various in the spectrum of ways that these institutions are approaching, are trying to deliver education?
Well, there's a wide range, as you can imagine, wide range of administrative arrangements across the country. There are programs operated by the juvenile justice agencies themselves. There are programs and special school districts sometimes that are operated by state departments of education. You have programs like the Maya Angelou Academy, which I'm sure David will talk more about later this afternoon, that really is a contract between a provider, a nonprofit, and a juvenile justice agency. You have charter schools. I know of several, but one in Colorado that's located in Aurora, or actually Watkins, Colorado, but it's a charter in Denver. So there's a wide range of options that have been developed to deliver services for children who are locked up. From my perspective, there's no right ways. There are just more effective ways of doing those kinds of things, those core things that are essential to deliver quality services.
And similarly, it really varies state to state about the type of opportunities that young men and women who are incarcerated get. Unfortunately, sometimes the opportunities just are god-awful and not good at all, and other times they're quite robust. And like Peter said, the robustness is not directly aligned with whether it's a charter or a state agency or a special school district. A lot of it has to do with who's in charge and are they prioritizing education, and does the governor and the person who runs the state agency really, really care about this, and do they hire superintendents and people on the ground that really make education a priority? If you do that, then you have a lot of different options. Some places are more vocational in focus, and if they do that well, they have some great outcomes. Some places are more technology and sort of technology instruction related, and some of them, like the Maya Academy, are sort of what we would call sort of generalist places that are really trying to help kids get a good broad base of education that they otherwise wouldn't get while they're with us, and are a little agnostic onto the sort of specific silos. Peter knows more about this than me, but I think the research is a little – none of those are better or none of those are worse, but what makes them good are some real critical factors about the quality of delivery and meeting kids where they're at and making sure we tackle key academic challenges so that kids get well-armed when they leave. And that's what we want to be focused on, is getting all states and counties to be able to put some really basic things in place that will up the ante and sort of just quickly up the quality of services.
Yeah, that's a good point, David. And you know, one of the things that I think about is the fact that when kids are detained or committed by the juvenile courts, the judge handling or the magistrate handling the disposition, if he he commits, for example, a youth for a six-month period or to a particular treatment program, he or she never says, oh, and by the way, we're going to give you a substandard education program. In nearly all states, if not all states, the children who are incarcerated are entitled to the same level of services and supports that kids in the public schools receive. Unfortunately, in many jurisdictions, they just don't receive that, and as David suggests, you know, it's a lot of times it's kind of the factors in the state. It's a governor, it's a superintendent, it's a contractor who's hired, who has a commitment to excellence and has the resources to deliver high quality services, that makes a difference between kids getting the services that they're entitled to and kids not getting those services.
So maybe, you know, you can take some time. You're talking about these factors that are showing successful outcomes when it comes to education. And you mentioned a few, David, but if you could take sort of each one and talk about them, maybe give some examples of them at play, some of the challenges that can be and how different states have been meeting those challenges, I think that would be really helpful to our audience. Is that possible?
Sure.
Okay.
Again, Peter, I think, you know, has a broader base than me. I can give a couple examples of things that have been successful at our school, and I'm sure Peter can add some ideas about things that are working in other places. But an example is when you have 16 and 17-year-olds who read at the first and second grade level, and unfortunately that's a fairly significant portion of the young men who are in these facilities, you have to be very aggressive, but also very thoughtful in the way that you're going to tackle these literacy gaps and help these young men learn to read. And at ours, at Maya Angelou, we've taken what we would call a blended approach. We, for all of the young men who are testing at the third grade level or lower, they get 1 hour a day of intensive, kind of phonics-based instruction in a very private, comfortable space where they're only working with one or two other young men and a literacy coach. This is really hard, detailed, rigorous work that a lot of us did when we were really, really young. And it can be frustrating. And candidly, if it's the only thing you do when you're 17, then you quit because you don't want to only do phonics. You want to be reading. So we, in addition to that, have that student participate with the rest of his peers also in a 90-minute English class. And during part of that 90-minute English class, that child gets to pick a book that is appropriate to him, and we know we have books leveled out, and he has a set of books that he can select from and he has some ownership of, but we're not candidly letting him pick a book. That's way too hard. Everybody's picking a book and everybody's reading a book and working with a tutor on a book that makes sense to them and that they want to read, but that what we know on the back end is also sort of meeting them where they're at and starting to help them build their literacy skills. Then when they transition to the rest of their English class, even if this young man can't read all the passages as fluently as some of his peers or write as well, those English teachers are coached they're really instructed to differentiate their instruction, and they know where their students are. And so Kenny, who might be reading at the third grade level, is still benefiting by being in a class where everyone is talking and reading about A Lesson Before Dying, as an example. And if he can't read it all, he might be getting some of it by listening to a book on tape. He might be getting some of it because he's at a table with some other peers reading it. But he's participating in the Q&A about it. And for the most part, he might have really good oral listening skills, and he might have very good comprehension skills. He just doesn't have good reading comprehension skills. So at the end of the day, he's been in 2.5 hours of English, an hour of intensive phonics work, another 30 minutes a day getting a chance to read and read a book that he got to choose, that's at his level, and another 60 minutes reading and writing and participating with the rest of his peers in a supportive way, and candidly sort of participating in sort of the mainstream sort of dialogue about what's going on. And that's healthy for him because he has things to offer and things to learn from a discussion of a middle or high school level book, even if he can't get through every passage in it. So people might do that differently, but to hit one specific example, a 17-year-old reading at a second or third grade level, you just can't let that kid leave 9 months later and not have decided to try to tackle basic literacy. And you can't tackle basic literacy unless you don't do it in some interesting, robust, and sort of technically proven ways. And Peter probably has examples of how other schools are doing this a little differently, but I think they all have some similar components to them. When you're trying to help a 17-year-old get to the point where in a year or two he's a reader, not a struggling reader.
Yeah, no, those are good. Those are great points, David, and a good example. I mean, I think for me, the notion of kind of individually tailored instruction combined with being part of a learning community, so that you're not just in that little one-to-one situation all day where you don't have a chance to talk about issues with your peers, also the idea of once you're in that regular class, your teachers are well aware of your abilities and the kinds of supports you might need. The kind of thing that makes me cringe when I visit facilities and I'm aware that there's a very heterogeneous group of learners in the classroom is when they start the round robin reading, and you know that there's going to be a couple of kids that are going to really struggle, and that's when bad stuff happens, because you know it's not socially acceptable to be ignorant or to not be able to read even at a sixth or seventh grade level. And so you know that's when the name calling and the throwing and whatever, because then it diverts attention from the fact that you're not capable, and then of course the agency or the school or the teacher, you know, the easy thing to do is to blame the kid, is to say, oh, you know what, these kids didn't appreciate and didn't apply themselves when they were on the outside, and now that they're incarcerated, they're doing the same kind of stuff, as opposed to saying, wait a second, have we designed an instructional environment that sets the stage for failure, because we're going to embarrass this young man in front of his peers, and, you know, none of us like to be embarrassed. And so, you know, without a planful approach to this whole challenge of literacy, which I think is one of the you know two or three big core pieces of education in a correctional environment, without that kind of planful thinking, the program is not going to succeed. As David was talking, I was thinking about a couple of things. One is the notion of individualized instruction. For part of the time, or individually tailored instruction. The idea that instruction is intensive. At David's school, the Maya Angelou Academy, and at other places like the Ferris School in Wilmington, Delaware, at Ridgeview Academy in Colorado, and at the Olamana School in Kailua, Hawaii. You know, what distinguishes those programs, which I think are very good programs, is there's an intensity to the instruction that, you know, kids are engaged in rigorous activities. Teachers are not just, you know, sitting at their desks. They're moving around the classroom. The kids are writing, they're talking, they're reading, they're reacting, just a very engaged, very planful way of discussing and presenting instructional activities to students. I think a couple of other points. One is this notion of mentoring. Some of the really good programs have, whether it's peer-to-peer mentoring or whether it's outsiders who come in and volunteer time, so that those youth who need the most support have a caring non-family adult, can be someone who's just a few years older than they are, who is really committed to supporting them, asking them how things are going, sometimes doing a little one-to-one work with them. I mentioned, as did David, a focus on literacy. I think a focus on numeracy is another important part of that. And then finally, the idea that there's got to be some normalizing kinds of experiences. So, for example, when David talked about a class, an English class, reading a lesson before dying, the idea that, you know, that's a book that adolescents or young adults might read, and it presents readers with a lot of really great ideas, and it's terrific for kids to have access to that kind of content, so that they're not just being exposed to stuff like Goosebumps because that's all they're capable of reading independently.
Yeah, let me add just a little bit to what Peter said on he used the word normalizing. A big piece of what we did at Maya was we came into the school with sort of an odd presumption, which was that a lot of things that make schools fun and interesting and engaging on the outside should take place at a school on the inside of a correctional facility. And that was sort of an anathema to some people. But to us, it made sense. And it really does make sense. There are things that, for almost all of us, make us more likely to get engaged and to be interested and to just spark the curiosity that's in our brains. And I think there is a lot of residual carryover in correctional institutions where people just are afraid to do that or won't do that, and they somehow think these guys don't want that or that won't work for them. So at our school, for example, we have very short units, which we can talk about later if it makes sense. And so instead of breaking the year up into quarters, which is a long time, we break it up into basically month-long chunks. And during that month is just filled with chances for guys to get good feedback. So they get a report card every month. We have a big award ceremony every month. Teachers give out certificates to kids who've accomplished a lot during that every month. We have school-wide awards like the Barack Obama Leadership Award and the James Forman Senior Advocacy Award and the Ella Baker Award for Creativity. And when kids get these awards, they get certificates. We have plaques, and the plaques are prominently displayed in the school, kind of like when you walk into a private school, you see these, you know, big plaques and trophies that make people proud. And our take has been, like, there's reasons why people put plaques up on the wall and put kids' names on them and highlight them, because they're demonstrating behaviors and characteristics that you want to your school to embody. And we were, I think, sort of naive, but we, in hindsight, were really either lucky or smart, because our school and a lot of the schools that Peter's mentioned, there's schools and youth correctional facilities that just feel exciting and kind of fun, normal, and there's other ones that just feel, what's the right word, Peter? Sort of desultory and just sort of, you know,
yeah,
down and everyone's kind of beaten down and docile. And you want the former, not the latter. And all these things can happen. You just have to usually do them and make some minor adjustments to how you would do them on the outside. But doing them on the inside makes things real, and that matters a lot.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, David. And I think the barriers are in people's heads. You know, the idea that we can't do this because this is juvenile corrections, or we can't do this for whatever reason. But, I mean, I over the last few years, I've seen things like BotBall, which is the kind of a robotics program where kids build robots and then learn how to program them, and then they compete with other schools in their communities and in the state. And, you know, kids get excited and staff get excited, and they want to be the faculty or the staff
sure.
kind of monitor for those programs. You know, in Hawaii a couple of years ago, the kids were doing moot court, where, you know, you had a couple of law students and you had a retired attorney working with kids to be part of a moot court team that competed with other schools on the outside. A lot of places have student papers, and to the extent that they've got a great faculty advisor that really, you know, works with the kids to develop the creativity and to develop the editing skills and those kinds of things, kids thrive when given those opportunities. Student government is another example. A facility that I'm working with in California has, in the last year, started a student council, and I've had the opportunity to be in the school during election cycle a couple of times, and, you know, there'll be posters up, and kids will be given their talks over the PA system, and it's just very exciting. And then finally, and this is some stuff that has happened in the D.C. facility, Oak Hill, the predecessor to New Beginning, the youth there were involved in dramatic productions, and then were part of a Shakespeare festival. And almost invariably, when you do these things, kids rise to the occasion, they get excited about it, and the rest of the world is amazed. It's like, wow, I didn't think these kids could do these kinds of things. As David said earlier, you know, these are kids, and the same things that excite and motivate kids who are not incarcerated motivate and excite kids who are locked up. And I think sometimes we forget that, and we feel like the only thing we can do is provide a dry, not very innovative kind of program, and then we wonder why the kids aren't so excited about it or don't respond to what we're trying to do.
Well, I mean, those are great examples of how, if we honor and inspire the youth, how they can succeed. One of the things Peter, you said is that a lot of the barriers are in people's heads, although in litigation around conditions of confinement and when other issues are raised, you always hear economics as an issue because you're talking about individualized approaches, trying to meet the number of hours that kids should be in school, working with a population that does have typically more behavioral issues. So what are your responses to meeting those challenges and other reasons institutions are giving for not taking these approaches?
Boy, we could talk for a couple of hours about this. I mean, there's a gazillion reasons that states give for not being able to do it. It's, you know, the most frequent one is blame the kids. You know, these kids have never demonstrated that they really want to learn, and so it's impossible. They destroy stuff. They don't take care of stuff. They don't pay attention in class. They act out, and so we have to exclude them from class. So that's kind of one piece of it. The economic one, I just don't get. In part because, it's from my perspective, it's an equal. You know, I'm speaking as a non-lawyer here who thinks he knows what he's talking about, but it's an equal protection issue. Most state constitutions say education is one of the core functions of the state, and if you're under a particular age, you know, 16, 17, 18, you're entitled to free education. And so what happens is, these agencies, these juvenile justice agencies, don't have well-developed funding mechanisms for their education program. They're not driven by the same kinds of their funds aren't generated the same way that public schools are funds are generated. They typically don't have school boards. They don't have parents who advocate on behalf of the kids. or maybe there's one or two parents, but it's not, it doesn't provide the kind of support that a, an administrator or a politician feels he or she needs in order to ensure that they get the resources for the kids. So what happens is things get really bad, and then a group like the Justice Department, the Civil Rights Division of Justice, or the ACLU, or the Youth Law Center, or the Juvenile Law Center, one of these groups, or the Children's Law Center that you're affiliated with, Lauren, file suit on behalf of kids. I wish I could say that education is one of the primary issues that, that drives these suits, and once in a while it is, but usually it's because of conditions, and kids are literally being treated very badly physically or emotionally, and then education gets kind of tossed on as another issue. But there's been a number of states that have abysmal education programs in their juvenile facilities that have been sued by some of these public interest law firms or by the Justice Department, where education is not part of the mix. And, you know, I don't know all the reasons for that, but, you know, education sometimes doesn't attract as much attention, because when kids get bad education, maybe they'll act out or they don't do what we want them to do, but they're not going to bleed and they're not going to die, at least not in a literal sense, although, you know, economically and their future isn't very bright when they don't receive educational services. So that's just kind of a quick take on you know, why some of this stuff doesn't happen. I think funding's part of it. I think political will. You know, politicians don't get points for saying, I'm going to make sure kids that are locked up and that get in trouble, that they're well-educated. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a politician say that.
You know, Lauren, on your kind of a piece of that question was I think sort of the notion of are people, the kids, for lack of a better word, are sort of uneducable, meaning their behaviors are so off the charts that it provides an excuse to fall back into some really bad educational practices. And I think that is true, and I think Peter's kind of said that. That is true. Again, we found some things to be very, very true going in the opposite direction, which is we spend a lot of time designing and spend a lot of time working with our young men on coaching and talking about basic social skills and developing a set of basic expectations that we expect in the school. And we have a very sort of robust behavior incentive system, which feels kind of like elementary school or middle school, where there's a lot of acknowledgments for students demonstrating one of a few key values that we as a school think are important. And when students demonstrate these values in the middle class, teachers give them cards, like an actual piece of paper, and write a note on it and say congratulations. And those kind of cards and points get tallied and they get accounted for and posted all over the boards, and they result in awards, and they result in a lot of pats on the backs, etc. And one of the things that we've found, and I've did a lot of work with our staff on, is that you know, the bell curve in our schools is similar to a lot of other bell curves in all these other schools out there, meaning if you put really good behavior management systems in place and you really stick with them, what you'll find is that the vast majority of young men improve and start to buy into the behavioral norms that you want. And the norms that you want aren't robots, but you do want young men to be developing the skills they need so they can be successful in your classroom or at work. What we've also found is that at any given time at our school, there was a small number of young men for whom sort of our behavioral sort of interventions and supports likely don't work. And one of the lessons we've taken away is if there are a handful of young men for whom this is not working, you need to think about new strategies to try to make the school work for those young men. But on the other hand, you can't make it the fact that it doesn't work for a small piece of the population give you reason to throw your hands up and say we shouldn't keep doing it, right? At any school in the country, there at any given time are a few kids who, unfortunately, are not making it very well, right? And I'm not saying that's a good thing. So again, we use some really robust tools that, again, other good schools use when they are trying to help kids develop positive social behaviors. And if you do them and if you're relentless in them, what you'll find is your school climate will become fairly effective. And then some of the things that Peter's talked about, or I've talked about, are a lot more available. You then can have an interesting discussion in English class, and you will build some norms up so that when a student can't read very well, that his peers don't laugh and make fun of him as compared to help him. Right, and that's how you have to believe those things are going to happen and be relentless on them. And if you do, then one of the barriers, not the barrier about funding or about why, but the barrier of the kids are just too poorly behaved, goes away, because you basically will it away by willing into action the school climate that you want. One other piece on that, which again may come up later, is there's also a lot of research around sort of the tension and sometimes the frailty of the relationship between the educational team and sort of the correctional team. And we found at our school that over the course of our 4 years, I mean, we've gotten closer and closer and have become more effective together as a partnership between the school and the youth agency as compared to the reverse. And in fact, this year we're piloting a number of initiatives where the school and the institutional staff together are training, co-training each other, and then training students on key social and behavioral skills. And that's taken a long time, 4.5 years. But partly, we're still going at it, and we didn't want to quit because we actually know that that's another real key, which is to get the school staff and the correctional staff to start using the same language with kids.
Well, that sounds terrific, David. I didn't know you were doing that. It started on that. That's
yeah.
Great. And you know, I think the point you're making is it's about shaping the climate and shaping the environment in a way that pulls for or presses for appropriate pro-social behavior. And I think the things that you mentioned, you know, being explicit and recognizing kids when they behave in ways that are consistent with what we expect of young men, for example, I think that's a great example of what these facilities, these institutions need to do, so that it's okay to work hard and to try hard in school, and it's okay to say, you know, please and thank you, and to just be explicit about kind of being good citizens in that environment, I think is a real key.
Well, we do have some questions coming in, and I also want to remind our listeners that if they want to talk to Peter or David live, you can call 347-994-1149 and then press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. One of the things that I had asked you to speak about was sort of, were there any differences in educating a population that's in detention versus in the state secure facilities due to the length of time? And we've actually had two listeners also ask about how does what you're talking about translate to youth who are in adult correctional facilities? So I'll let you determine where you want to start with all of that.
Yeah, well, there's kind of three different populations. I mean, there's the detention, as you're presenting it, and then long-term juvenile and then adult corrections. Is that correct, Lauren?
Yes.
David, do you want me to take a stab at this one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, I think the challenge of juvenile detention, of course, is that kids are in and out at a fairly rapid pace. You know, you go to many facilities and they'll tell you that their average length of stay is 5 days or 10 days, and they'll say, oh, and a lot of kids are just in here overnight. My belief is that that those kids are entitled to high quality services, but it may take a different instructional organization. It may take perhaps a different curriculum. And let me elaborate on that just a little bit. So, for example, if you have kids coming in and turning over pretty quickly, in some facilities they have what's often called an intake classroom. And the intake classroom is a class where they might do some initial screening of kids, you know, everything from literacy to general knowledge stuff, that maybe some mental health screening will be done during that, in that first week or two in that intake classroom. And most of the movement is in and out of that room. Once kids are there for a couple of weeks, then they move into the regular or the general program. And there are kids in juvenile detention that'll be incarcerated for 6 months, for 9 months. They call it a detention center, and the average length of stay may be very low, but there's always a group of kids that are there for a long period of time. Sometimes it's because there's all kinds of legal wrangling going on in the courts about their case. Other times they will be committed, but they're committed to a facility that doesn't have an open bed. And so in some states, like Maryland, we refer to those kids as pending placement. So those kids go back to the detention center. And I know you have some students like that at Maya Angelou. So those kids, kids in detention centers who are there for more than a week or so, really need to have the same kind of intensive services and supports. Often juvenile detention centers are fairly small. But you can establish, for example, that literacy and numeracy and maybe current events or social studies or an occupational exploration kind of unit, that those are the core things that you do in those facilities, and you do them well. For some kids, what that might serve to do is to get them reengaged in education. Oh, education can be fun. I can enjoy it. Boy, I came in here and look what I can do now. In fact, I saw a video when I was in California a couple weeks ago of a young man whose reading scores had really jumped, and he was so excited, and he was being interviewed by one of his literacy coaches outside the classroom, and he was just going on and on about how much growth he had been able to demonstrate. And it was a combination of some technology-based supports as well as one-to-one tutoring, and he was just very excited about it. You know, in a detention center, you can achieve all kinds of things, but too often, not just educators, but others say, well, you know, the kids are here for a short period of time. If push comes to shove and you really want to determine how long kids are in a detention center, you know, you take the length of stay, list of length of stay, and you break it up into quartiles. And what you'll find is that in the third and fourth quartile, you get kids that are there for a long period of time. We've talked a little bit about kids in juvenile corrections, but in adult corrections, oftentimes kids who are under 18 are going to be housed and educated separately. But in adult corrections, often it's very much a vocational ed model or vocational ed program. And once students hit 18, they, unless they've got special ed needs, and then perhaps until they're 21, they don't have kids who are not special education eligible. They do not necessarily have entitlements to education the way they do when they're younger. So in many adult correctional facilities, there's waiting lists to get into classrooms, to get into vocational programs, to do all kinds of things that I think most of us think should be more readily available. David, do you want to jump in here?
Well, I think Peter did an excellent job of breaking up the three tranches. In the second piece, which is kids in long-term state facilities, which is where we've primarily been focused, you still have issues of kids coming and going a lot. And that's an example of where we've tried to adapt, take a regular school year and break it up into these small sort of 22 to 24 instructional day units. That way kids come in and going at different times. There's always a point of entry. You're never here saying, oh, I've just missed the whole first, you know, 2/3 of the first quarter of a year, and therefore nothing I do for the next month could possibly matter because I'm not going to get my credits. Our goal is to say, hey, look, every 23 days here you can get 1/8 of a credit, and what we do is every unit you get a report card, you get a progress report, your credits get added up that shows you how you're building credits. It shows you how many credits you've gotten to date. And that we found that's very motivating and matters a lot to young men, especially young men who in the past haven't been successful at getting a lot of credits. So and each one of those shortened units means, again, that there's something new and something to hold on to and a project to get done. And one of the real keys to our success, I believe, has been to anchor the school year in these short units, because a lot of things that I've talked about can flow through them. The ability to acknowledge kids' efforts quickly can happen. You get kids engaged and get them clear progress reports can happen. We can commit to meetings and aligning ourselves with state standards, but nonetheless, within these short chunked units, do some more interesting, relevant content while still trying to meet some skill set standards. That's been very, very helpful, I think, for us. And as Peter said, you can do similar things in a short-term context. You might make your chunks more like a week, right? And you might have 3 to 5 day sort of mini projects that are thematic and work and are engaging and hit basic skills and are break upable enough that even if you're only there for 2 of the days, you can probably get into the project, get something done, and get out of the project, again, even if you're not there for the full 4 days. For the juveniles and adults, I think Peter laid that out really, really well. It's just a very tough nut, and once you're over 18, there's no guarantee you're going to get educated if you're in an adult system. And unfortunately, if you're 16 in an adult system, you're not likely to get a very good education because, again, you got to remember you're now a very minority population in a large
right.
place that doesn't have systems in place to do large-scale education, right? So it's you're probably an afterthought, I think, is kind of, you're probably
yeah.
There's only a few of you there, and somebody is yelling at folks saying, don't you remember you got 8 16-year-olds there and you're obligated to educate them? Well, you're in a system, in an institution that is mostly dealing with a bunch of 30- and 40-year-olds who don't need or maybe don't want to go to school. And so it's, I think it's a much harder structural issue that there are really no good answers to other than generally trying to keep the young men out of those places.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, David. A big change that happened, I want to say 10 to 15 years ago, when the Congress said that Perkins monies for career and technical education could no longer be spent on prisoners. Programs all over the country closed, and so the amount of resources available to provide services, particularly in adult corrections, was diminished big time. And so you had more prisoners each successive year competing for fewer numbers of seats in classrooms and programs.
This may end up being an interesting place where education technology could help make some difference. I'm hopeful and hope to make a difference in this space. I think it may, particularly if you look at, again, sort of subpopulations, young men in adult facilities, we might be able to at some point find some creative solutions. It's not that a computer is a solution to that young man's educational needs, but it may be that an e-tutor and a computer monitor, and candidly the access simply to internet to video stream into another classroom that isn't taking place there, but you're a live person and you're using a more sophisticated version of Skype, and you're actually a student in a room with other 16-year-olds. You happen to not be sitting there, but your teacher can literally see you, and you can see the teacher. We might have some interesting solutions or some interesting things to pilot in some of these places.
Yeah, I that's a good point, David. Not quite the same as distance learning, but There's a pilot starting in California in a juvenile facility, a Kindle book club, where kids are going to be jointly reading using electronic books. And the few kids that I've talked to about are very excited about the possibilities. And again, it's kind of helping kids stay connected to things that are going on in the larger world and getting them excited about the printed word and about the use of this interesting, relatively new tool.
Great. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and there's another question, and I just want to make sure we reserve enough time for final thoughts and resources that you want to share. There was a question, because you were talking about the promising practices, someone want to know, how do we create better accountability measures for juvenile detention correction systems regarding education? And, for example, are any states doing good monitoring through state education, state departments of education? What have you seen that works, and how can people who in their own states foster that?
I can start this perhaps. A school that I've visited on numerous occasions and that I think has demonstrated the ability to turn itself around and to sustain that over time is the Ferris School in Wilmington, Delaware. My colleague Dolores McIntyre is the principal there, and she and her team have developed, with support from the Delaware, I think it's Department of Children and Families, have really developed and sustained a program that in which treatment and education at the Ferris School are fairly well integrated. They use elements of a positive peer culture environment where kids kind of talk about daily activities. There's a lot of external groups coming into the facility for arts activities and mentoring. They've committed, after being, like Oak Hill, a really abysmal facility, the state is committed to kind of turning things around. And now it's been about 20 years since they've transformed that institution. If I think about some other examples, it's leadership at the state level. In Colorado, a facility I mentioned earlier called Ridgeview Academy, it got off the ground. It's a public-private partnership, but it got off the ground, and it's gotten support from legislators in the state of Colorado because it's less expensive than other options, and it's less expensive because it uses elements of a positive youth culture. It doesn't have a big fence around it. Its resources go into things like a library and an auditorium and, intensive vocational and academic programming. And each kid is not locked in an individual cell that's plumbed individually, and that's just very expensive to do. They're in little pods. And so it's just a very different model than you find in many states. I don't know and have not visited the Missouri facilities, but I do know that they're small. I know that there's a big emphasis put on the kind of the learning community, the living community that the kids are in. They report very, very good outcomes in terms of recidivism and kids staying out of the system once they're released. So, I think it's a combination of things. I think the political culture in a given state dictates to a large degree what's going to happen. I guess the flip side of it, and too often this is what encourages people to do what I consider to be the right thing, is when states do bad things to kids, the cost, not just to the kids, but the cost to the state, from the litigation to ultimately the taxpayers, is huge. It's just huge. And in some states, there'll be protracted litigation for years before they settle. And in other places, there's a complaint filed, and the state or the local jurisdiction will say, well, we want to fix it, let's sit down. And that complaint is the is the vehicle that's used by the local or state politicians to get the resources they need to put the correct or the most appropriate kind of program in place.
Okay, so it's time for final thoughts. The hour went very quickly. I don't know if you, whatever you want to share as far as tips. I know, David, you talked about the tensions. I don't know if you want to talk about, even share some things that helped the education community, the correctional facility, work through those tensions. But whatever you'd like to share with our listeners and some resources would be wonderful.
Sure. Well, I'll just do two things quickly then. To get back to the last question, you know, one of the questions was about sort of accountability. I think that actually highlights at a big picture level the tension in this space. I think for many people, their real belief is that it's virtually impossible to hold these places accountable, and therefore many people in the sort of juvenile justice reform community are still pushing forward, thankfully, to basically have as many of these long-term youth correctional facilities shut down and to get as many young men as can be back in their communities to be back in their communities. And one of the reasons I know that they believe that is because it's very hard for these to be anything other than throwaway places. I do think if we can move the industry a little further along, although some things like No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress won't quite work in these facilities, there are things, particularly in the long-term facilities as compared to the detention facilities, that state agencies could be asking for that, although a little generic, would give some pretty clear signals to whether kids were going to school every day and having a chance to learn. And I think we might make some progress on that there's just four or five key levers that if you at least pay attention to these, it'll give us all a lot more comfort that for the young men who are there, they at least are getting an adequate, if not a really good, education. And I think that might happen, again, with some just better capacity to use technology to monitor four or five basic levers, especially around student performance. Anybody that's with you for 9 months, you ought to be able to suggest that you gave them an intake assessment and an exit assessment and suggest and show some results. And that is something that states could now be tracking pretty easily. And if those were consistently moving downward or flat, then the state agency should move in just as they would in a more traditional community setting. So I think some of that could happen. On the first point that you raised, the vast majority of people who work in youth corrections are good people, and they want good things to happen to the kids that are there. And I think that's, in one sense, that's just sort of a trivial statement that seems trite, but it's true. And a piece of this is to find the common ground. Educators and sort of correctional officers or youth development officers, there are some basic things that we all want for our kids. We want them to be able to improve their academics, and we want them to be able to demonstrate the skills they'll need to be successful on the outside. Everybody just believes that. It's everybody does. And so then the next key is, if we believe that, let's focus on the few things that we can agree upon and build around them and not get stuck at the moment on what we do or don't disagree with on the margins, because in the middle, we all agree that there's some basic sort of performance behaviors that we want to emphasize with our kids. And let's agree on those, and let's go try to work together to help our kids pick those up.
Peter?
No, those are great points, David. And I'm glad you mentioned the idea of periodically measuring the academic growth. I hear from some facilities a concern about not being able to meet the AYP goals in No Child Left Behind. And part of it is because they have a different group of kids 1 year to the next. It's not really, there may be just one or two kids in the facility that are the same ones that were there when they tested the year previously. But I think what you're talking about is a kind of a growth model in which we compare, when we look at the performance of the program by looking at individual kids at 3 or 6 or 9 month intervals, whatever is most appropriate, and then look at an agency and an educational program's ability to demonstrate that they can make the kids more competent academically in a number of different areas. And I think that's a real important point.
Well, Peter and David, thank you so much for being on Spotlight on Youth and actually sharing, I think, some exciting things that are happening around education and hopefully inspiring people out there. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.children'slawky.org. You'll find some resources pertaining to today's show posted there, and if you listened in to our show last time on House Bill 86, there are some new fact sheets. So take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you again.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you for having us.